Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir.
General Quarters 3,
oh dear, here we go again.
GQ 3, intruder alert.
No, it's not really an intruder. Okay, thank you. You're doing a great job. Hi, good evening and welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon. And I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, also known as Jennifer Perry. And I am thrilled so much to have all of you listening here and that your continued support that I keep getting from Madame Perry Salon, because my mission is to bring you some of the most fascinating people. And I got to say, I'm pretty fortunate and rather blessed to know some of the most fascinating people in the world. Just to let you know, coming up in the next few weeks, I'm going to have sociologist Randy Blazak, or that's Randy Blazak, PhD, and he's got a new book out called The Dream Police. Also tomorrow, Heather Ash Amara, writing her Love Warrior Goddess book series, and you're going to enjoy her. Also, Harvey J.K., who wrote Fighting for the Four, the Fight for the Four Freedoms. Harvey J.K. is you probably know who he is. If you do, you know you're going to love this. Also, Rudy Sarzo. You might remember Rudy, especially if you love the bass, you love the bottom. Rudy was bass player with Ozzy Osbourne, Quiet Riot. He's got a book called Off the Rails, and it's mostly about his time with Ozzy and about his good friend Randy Rhoads, the guitar player. And so he's coming up soon. Also Phoebe Legere. Just got lots of good folks coming in, and I am so psyched. But tonight, I've been waiting for this. Tonight, I've got a gentleman here, and he is, I don't know where to begin. He's a Grammy-nominated, award-winning producer and performer, currently on tour with the Gap Band. You heard me, Burn Rubber on Me, with the Gap Band through 2017. and now that you can hear him laughing, I'm going to bring him on in. Please, welcome to Madame Perry Salon, Frank DeVille Greenfield. Come on in. I know. Is a beaded curtain got you confused? Just come on in. Find a nice cushion to sit on.
Yeah, I think it smells really good in here, too.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, not too long ago, my friend Becky Kyle, who's a writer, and actually for a long time she was one of the judges of the Amazon Breakout Novel Award. She brought in a few suspense writers, and they had hid some burritos in the cushions, and it took forever to get all that out of there and the smell. And should have known. You know, one's retired military. One was an attorney, a trial attorney, and also a opera singer at night and suspense. You should know where you can bring that kind of riffraff in. I love you, Cornell. I love you, Brett Wright. I love you, Rick Cornell. You know I'm teasing you. But that's what happens, and it's all good. So welcome. Glad to have you in here. Get a nice cushy cushion. Sit down, and let's talk about you. Now, who would be to call you DeVille? Frank?
Actually, you can call me Frank. You can call me Frank DeVille. You know, it's a name that some guys from my crew kind of gave me. In certain cultures, like, they don't call each other by their real name. And they just make up names. So, you know, when I was working with the Mosley Group in Timberland and Walter Millsap, they called me Mr. DeVille. So, you know, it kind of stuck. So Yeah, just stink is good.
In certain cultures, I like that. In certain cultures, listen, I never underestimate the value of a good alias myself. And sometimes you never know who you're going to be and where you're going to be that person. So, yeah, I can dig it.
Yeah, well, I mean, certain like in pop and in hip hop and R&B. I mean, I don't know, just most of the people I work with, you know, we're it's a very broad brush of who we are, our backgrounds, you know, the color of our skin, and so yeah, that's what I kind of meant.
Yeah, well, that's it. I can dig it, and
yeah,
and why not? And you know what? It's even better. It's even better when these people give you the cool nickname or the cool alias. That just shows you've
that's
already got.
That's absolutely right. Yes, yes. I wouldn't do it myself. I wouldn't, you know. So it's kind of more respectful, I think, in some ways.
Well, yeah. Or as we learned from Big Bang Theory, how the other astronauts have to give you your nickname, not your not yourself. When Howard, I don't know if you watch Big Bang Theory. You probably don't watch TV. You're too busy writing songs for TV.
Yeah, I don't. I do. And I don't even own a TV. But but I'm aware of certain shows because I have, you know, a lot of music in TV shows. And but it's interesting that what you said about Big Bang Theory, actually, I've never seen it, but that, you know, other people have to give you that nickname. And it sort of is like, that's kind of the way it is, I guess. I would, you know, my guys that I work with in the industry never call me by Frank or Frank Greenfield. It's always Mr. DeVille. Mr. DeVille, how about this? Mr. DeVille, how's it going? You know, Mr. DeVille, you're going to come over, you know, for a session or.
That's Mr. DeVille. I can see. So somebody has should, now. I was going to say I've already got a text from somebody who's probably going to call in or messages, questions in. My good friend David Hurley. He's a poet and author, and his last published book is Sharon Tate and the Daughters of Joy, and he publishes a magazine. But he said, "Man, this guy's credentials are impressive." Yeah. So let's go ahead and get started with that. You began, now you started off with your training, studying classic guitar and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right? Okay.
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then later
I realized, go ahead.
Oh, no, you got the story, man. You go.
Oh, well. So I had been playing, you know, guitar and drums. Drums were my first instrument when I was, you know, a little kid. I got to the point I realized that guys that were really had a voice in the music industry were studying that kind of an idiom. You know, at that time, like the great, you know, rock guys and you know, R&B guys, they had those kind of backgrounds in jazz and especially classical. So I really threw myself into it, and it was really eye-opening because when you're studying, like, classical guitar, everything else, like, gets kind of thrown out the window. It was like, back to the beginning. But I learned how to read music. I learned a lot about music theory, which I never knew. I was always kind of an ear player. I took lessons here and there and knew how to play certain songs, but I totally went to a whole nother level, you know, studying, especially with the kind of people I was studying with. I attended Westminster Conservatory of Music in Princeton, and it was one of those things where, you know, I was working a regular day job and practicing my guitar for like 6 hours a day. That's what it took, or else there was no use in studying like that. You know,
right?
And even now with pop and R&B, it like music on the radio might sound very simple, but there's a lot of like voicings and certain things when you know your way or in the modes on the guitar or in music that really open up a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's due to pretty much my training in classical and jazz. There's a great guitar player, John Holdsworth, that said, learn everything you can and then forget it. So you get all that knowledge. And I realized, like, you know, in guitar, there's a lot of places I won't go in music theory because I just don't utilize it, you know. But I'm a firm believer in it's good to be able to play by ear and train your ear, but also formal training.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. So what do you think the formal training did to help prepare you for what you're doing now? Because you've done, not only do you work with artists of all genres, whether it's hip-hop or gospel music, or rock. But you do a lot of television and movie work. So how did the basis or your, what do you call it, your foundation of classical and jazz help you or benefit you, or did it?
Well, yeah, it did. It also goes back to a couple years ago, I was fortunate to have some people that kind of guided me in my career. And a guy that at the time was working at Warner Brothers, he said, Frank, if you want to be on the radio, you listen to the radio. Now, I guess you could say the same thing about the TV,
mm-hmm.
which I still own the TV. But all the music that I have that's in TV and film, most of it was on pop records initially or written for pop artists.
Uh-huh.
So listening to the radio and then having the background and being able to express ideas musically, and I'm more of a creative producer. I know how to make things happen musically, like in the emotion of a song, like how to lift the choruses and things like that. And that's like universal with, you know, a song that's, you know, on the radio behind an artist or a song that's on a TV show,
right.
You know, or film, you know. So again, it's a lot of it is just knowing. Like yesterday, I was working on a session for an artist, and it was pretty basic, but it was just, you know, you're kind of experimenting with different chord voicings. You know, there's places to play the same note all over the guitar. Guitars sound nice if they're in open tuning, like, you know, in a first position, nice big open chords. But then, you know, like the tonality and the timbre changes as you move up or around, or if you capo or if you tune down. So all those things, you know, that knowledge, a lot of those, that the basic foundation, you know, I learned, you know, through my training. Learning how to read music. I remember in studying jazz, and we were doing, so the guy that I was studying jazz with is this guy named Joe Federico. It wasn't at Westminster Conservatory, it was outside of there, but Joe was this kind of very mild-mannered, very soft-spoken guy that just really gave his whole life to teaching. And he was the guy that actually transcribed Paganini, if you know who Paganini, the violin player, was, transcribed it for guitar that all the big shots out in Los Angeles were doing. Like that kind of a method, two-note per string arpeggios and just all that crazy kind of guitar playing that came from, you know, Paganini, Vivaldi, you know. So you're learning a lot of those techniques and applying them to, you know, your instruments. So even in R&B, you know, a lot of it is chord structure and voicings, but, you know, a lot of times when you're ripping a solo, you're using a lot of those same kind of dynamic techniques that you would have never learned any other way. Maybe you could have picked it up off of an album and learned to play, like, you know, whoever you really like, but this way mm-hmm. you're really learning it, you know?
No kidding.
I told you. What's that?
I said, no kidding.
Yeah. I play that to other areas. of my life too. I'm a, you know, I'm a martial artist, I'm a black belt, and a lot of it is very, very basic training. When you get to a certain point, you've really only mastered certain basic skills, but that's the foundation, you know, and then everything you go, you know, builds on there.
I didn't know that. That's how you keep that lean rock and roll figure.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
You
that's
gotta
true.
Have it. You gotta, you know.
You do.
It's all, the other day I was listening to an interview, it was a town hall interview with Johnny Marr, and it was on First Wave. And the somebody asked a question about he's got a new book, and which I hope you'll have a book soon, because I know you got a lot of stories to tell. But
yes,
somebody commented that Iggy Pop had wrote a blurb for the back of his book, and it was all kind of wonderful comments about him when he saw him play. He says, "Well, how'd you feel when you read what Iggy Pop wrote about you?" He goes, "Well, I don't know, man, because he didn't say a thing about my great hair, and you know, my clothes." And,
he said about his great hair, or
about his great, about what cool hair, about his cool haircut. Just anything about my cool haircut and clothes, you know, because Johnny's like you, he's got a good sense of humor. And so he goes, and so the interviewer goes, "Oh, I see, because that was back in the days when it was all about the hair and the clothes." Johnny goes, "It still is about, it still is, man, it still is."
Yes, it is.
This is going to be like talking to DeVille, because he's got that same, you got the a sense of humor, same kind of like Johnny, you know, serious but then dry at the same time. So, yeah.
Well, it's silly, but it's very true. It is, you know, when you're looking to become a brand, you know, that's part of it. It's not everything, but it's you know, how you present yourself, and It is kind of funny, though.
Well, yeah, in fact, you know, you got a whole package. You want to create people. These days, people can do anything else with their time. They can just sit home and watch you on a video. They can watch this. For people to actually get up out of their homes these days to go out and be entertained and pay, maybe get a babysitter, you want to give them something special. You know, Marlena Dietrich, even touring, she would say, "I dress up for the shows because I want people to know I did. I want them to feel like I did this for you, because you come and see me. I want to do this for you. You know, everything is for the audience that comes." And you said, "Yeah, total package."
Yes. Well, thanks. Thank you. I you know, work hard at it.
You know, in all my research on you, I never did find any. I didn't find any pictures of you in your karate attire and accoutrement. So I don't know. That must be like a secret side of your life.
Facebook. If you see me on Facebook, yeah, you will. Normally, I with social media, I only put on there what I want people, what I want them to know about me, like
you're
things
a wise
about.
Man.
Yes, things about. You know, I'm a parent, but you won't see really anything about my. About my family or certain political or spiritual beliefs, you know. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
A lot of times, even being a martial artist, people have, well, especially guys, they have everything to say about it, you know. So, you know, I've been doing it for a long time. I was, and you know, I've been an instructor. I just do it, you know, I'm not a fighter. Consider myself much more of a lover. I do it for my head and, you know, like you said, just, you know, to stay in shape. And
now you can't see with your hands.
Well, see, that's the whole thing too, is that in the past, in my earlier days of training, you know, we would be breaking stuff and breaking bricks. Here's the thing. I am really paying for it now at this stage in my life with some of the crazy, like, traditional style training. But I'm glad I did it, but I, you know, developed, you know, some issues with arthritis and some things like that as I get older. But, you know, it's just, that's all part of it, you know. You just got to, you know, work through. Mainly with martial arts is I learned the tenacity of pushing through, of do or die. And I carried that into my music career because I really didn't break into the music career until I was a little bit older. And I had to have that attitude, having to be able to work through rejection, you know, validation, like so many no's, you know, so much disappointment. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of people really can't continue in that career, because it's just, it's debilitating.
It is. I mean, we're laughing, but we know it's legit. It's serious. By the way, if you want to call in tonight and talk to Frank DeVille Greenville, you just call 646-716-9922. 646-716-9922. You should already have that in your phone directories. And, yeah, just call, ask a question, a comment. Just we'll be yeah. So I want to talk right now about after your study at the Westminster Conservatory and with Robert Trent and then Joseph Federico, your bio says as one of the creative partners of the Dent Makers and Conjunction mm-hmm. Entertainment that your career broke. Frank's career broke with the release of Timbaland's Shock Value, which went 6 times platinum. Let's say that again, boys and girls. 6 times platinum and reached number 3 on the Billboard R&B. Now, first of all, that had to feel good.
I did. But again, if I told you that, so again, that didn't really happen until a later bit. You know, I jumped a lot between my training and, you know, having some, you know, being on some big records. My partner at the time was a guy named Lamar that I met in a parking lot. And we started writing together. And, you know, there's a whole lot, that's like a whole other story, which I won't go into it, but it was, we were both really working out some things in our life. And so we just kind of came together in this chance meeting. And then we met the gentleman who runs Conjunction Entertainment, who has been responsible for breaking a lot of artists. And he says to both of us when we meet him, after he had heard some of the music that we did together, which was, you know, pop, R&B, and hip-hop, he said, I can make you guys a household name. So we're like, great, you know, in a couple of weeks we're going to be set, you know. Well, we wrote 200 pieces of music before we got anything placed. We went through so much disappointment, you know, and when you're writing for an album, like, they might want 2 songs or 3 songs, but you're writing 6 or 10, you know, for them to choose from. And to answer your question, it did feel very good. It was... but again, it was working through that, being, you know, tenacious and saying, okay, this is really what I was born to do. That's going to be, I'm going to do it, or I'm going to die trying. And yeah, so then, you know, that was kind of like the way things opened up. And of course, when I started to learn a lot about the industry then too, because I thought I knew certain things about how to monetize your revenue streams, but now I had the ability to really, like, with some of those early placements, I had the opportunity then to secure a publishing deal and have someone, you know, collect my worldwide mechanical licensing. So yeah, it did feel good, and it was that one song when in the past you're like, if I can just get one song, right? But then you get 1 or 2 songs, and you're like, okay, if I can get, you know, 5 more.
and yeah, why not? Because if you even though you go through hundreds, you get those 2, you got a taste. You know, you got that taste for it, and you know you can do it, and let's keep going. Just a few more, just a couple more. Yeah, that's good. Let me finish reading this paragraph on your bio for people listening, and then I've got a question from David Hurley for you. He sent in that it says, Okay, so the Timbaland shock value went 6 times platinum and reached number 3 on the Billboard R&B chart. The following year brought 2 Grammy nominations for Trinity 5-7 and a GMA Dove Award for Best Urban Recorded Song of the Year for Listen, which peaked at number 9 on the gospel. And then, yeah, Billboard Gospel, it says you've written music, you've played guitar, you've done production work on what is called literally a who's who of pop and R&B artists like Beyonce, Usher, Kelly Rowland, Timbaland, Mindless Behavior, Onyx, Christine Storm, and you're also working with an artist named Lakota, I've seen. And who was the guy that you were working on? Was it American Idol? Was an artist?
Yeah. Yeah. His name is Clint June. When I say we, again, this was with my friend and partner Lamar Van Sciver. When working with the Mosley Group or with Conjunction Entertainment, we saw this is what it takes to really break an artist. This is what you do, and this is how you do it. Yeah, it's good to have placements and have music and TV and film, but the guys that were really doing it, they would get ownership of an artist, write the songs and everything. So my consultant at the time brought me the situation with a series, season 10, I'm sorry, American Idol finalist Clint June Gamboa, an enormous talent. So we started, producing and putting a record, together for him and getting all the things in place. And last December, we got him signed to Famous Music, Universal Worldwide. So it took about 3 years for it to happen. But, that's just one of the things that I've been working on. So, and we've done, tons of gigs and going on a couple of short tours and still actually looking, still breaking him. But it's turned out real good. It's turned out real good. Like I said, this is one of the things. I've got my publishing deal. I've got Clint. I'm out with the Gap Band. There's a couple side projects I'm working on, and I'm still, making records for other artists.
Well, let me go ahead right now and give you David Hurley's comments and questions, because he's just let me see, because he put this in. He says, earlier you mentioned that you essentially relearned guitar playing, which reminds me of Rush's Neil Peart. He put in the pronunciation. Thank you, David, because I've always pronounced it incorrectly. Rush's Neil Peart. Relearning. Listen, I called David Hurley. I called him other names before I've learned how to, before he gave me the phonetic spelling of his name, too. Anyway, of Rush's Neil Peart. Relearning his drumming technique from jazz drummer legend Freddie Gruber and having to reteach himself every performed Rush song in that alternative style. Anyway, like Peart, like Peart, you seem to have a basic respect for training and the art of the art. Going through your resume, for lack of a better term, I wonder two things immediately. Back in the day, did you ever imagine having achieved such recognition and success? And does one artistic accomplishment make you particularly proud or feel like you can die smiling? Corrected question. I went too fast there. Corrected question. Oh, I'm sorry. David, have I got that in there? Yeah, got it. Down here at the end, did you ever imagine you'd achieve such recognition and success? And does one artistic accomplishment make you feel particularly proud or feel like you can die smiling? There. That's it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's an encouragement when someone thinks of you like that. I think I always had this dream, and it was always you know, in me. I knew when I was, I came out to the West Coast when I was 15 with my parents. Just my dad was on a business trip, and I just fell in love with the West Coast. And I always had this kind of, I don't know, fantasy. Maybe it's not the correct word, but I thought it was something was always within my grasp. Mm-hmm. It's not that I really ever thought I was special, but I did have something. This is what it is, or what it was.
Uh-huh.
I thought I found out at an early age what my voice would be like in music. You know, I didn't really ever see myself as a star anything like that, but I found something that made me unique. And when I've spoken at, I was speaking to a couple colleges last year and talking to some people who were taking music courses and getting ready to go into the real world, and I would talk about finding your own lane. And there was something I realized from a young age, that I have a gift of rhythm and melody, and that is probably what I do best. So in some ways I could say yes, I thought this is bound to happen someday, and then on the other side of that, I am very grateful that I had the opportunity, you know, to be able to live out my dream, you know,
mm-hmm.
because I don't share this with a lot of people, and I might have mentioned this to you before, and almost in passing, but, you know, I'm a father of two adult children that I raised, and I, you know, was always working on my craft, but where I was living at the time, there was really no music scene. So when my children, you know, were out and on their own, then I decided, and I won't tell you what age that was, but I decided, okay, now it's my time. Now it's time to do or die. And I'm really grateful for that. The other side of the question is I realized a few years ago, looking at some of the people I worked with and looking at their careers, and again, like what started me in my career as my influences were not regular, like, you know, guitar heroes or recording artists that were stars, but guys that were great writers, great guitar players that they had. They were in, you know, one of them was a guy named Tommy Tedesco. He's passed away, but he wrote a lot of songs for Motown. He was on all these records. He did music for the Monkees. He did music for the TV shows, and I just thought that was the best thing. So when I came out here, I was working, you know, again with Walter Millsap from Conjunction, and he would be, you know, out with Lady Gaga on her Australian tour and then producing and doing all those things, and I'd be like, that's the kind of career that I really still want to have. So back in May, when I had this, you know, opportunity to join the Gap Band, which is a whole nother crazy story. The Gap Band for me is like, they're like the best, you know, it's like playing with Led Zeppelin. but it's like the Gap Band, you know, being able to, you know, play those songs, play those hits. It's a two-guitar, three-keyboard, you know, band. There's a lot of guitar work, probably more than I've ever done in a band, outside of some of the hard rock stuff I played back in the day. So I feel like right now is my time. If something, you know, if I was to leave this earth, I'd be like, okay, I did what I said I was going to do.
Mm. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I think about, I don't know if you've ever seen The World's Fastest Indian, that movie with Anthony Hopkins.
No.
It's about this guy, Burt Munro, from New Zealand, and he set the world land speed record on a 1921 Indian motorcycle. And he was a tinkerer and everything. And the movie is beautiful. Anyway, he's older. He sets this record, and and he crashes his motorbike. It's at the Indiana or Salt Flats out, I guess Indiana or whatever it is. And he's laying there and he goes, I did it. And it's just, it really kind of sends chills like, okay, I did it. I did what I said I was going to do. And
yeah.
Not that I'm going to stop now or that, you know, because still there's a lot more work ahead. Because now, you know, I leave my legacy and my music catalog to my children. And, but I heard people say in the music industry that it's a huge desert and it's like one glass of water. So I feel very fortunate to be able to take a little bit of that water.
Yeah, really. So we had a caller. If you want to call and talk to DeVille, the number is 646-716-9922, and that is toll-free anywhere in the continental U.S. We had a caller just a moment ago, but then they dropped. So if you, I don't know who it was, but somebody with, I think it was a 248 exchange or area code, call back.
Call back.
Unless you went to make a sandwich, then bring a couple back. Okay. For me and DeVille, right here in Madame Perry's
yes.
salon. You didn't pack a lunch.
Absolutely.
So call on back. All right, so from there, okay, well, you know what? Actually, we've got a little bit of something here. Some of the groups you played with, tell me about how you got involved. It sounds like you were in trouble. Tell me how you met and began to work with Trinity 5-7.
Well, Trinity 5-7 is like a gospel version of Destiny's Child. It's run by Matthew Knowles, who is the head of Music Growth Entertainment. And also Beyonce's dad. So when we were working with Conjunction and the Mosley Group, we would get a lot of these opportunities. See, a lot of times, like, people say, how can I write for, I got a great song. How can I get, you know, this artist to hear it or this artist? But what ends up happening is the labels look to established writers or established producers. And that's how they want to get their hits and their songs. So with Trinity, I'm trying to think is if we might have written this track for someone else. And the song Listen, which was, you know, a big hit for them and actually was, you know, won them a Grammy and a Dove Award, we had done really very organically some of the rhythm parts I had, like, done actually on my body rather than playing drums. We just kind of, like, slapped it out with microphones around, if you can imagine that. And they were looking for two singles. Yeah, they were looking for two singles, and that's, we kind of put this, you know, little happy thing with this whistling part on there and this little kind of blues guitar riff and a bunch of, you know, slapping on there, yeah. Again, that's how it usually, you know, works. You get the opportunity to, you know, to write for an album, and in this instance, they wanted, you know, two songs, and we wrote maybe five or six. But those two songs really, really had it. I mean, they really had something special. And, of course, when the girls, you know, when they wrote on them, you know, that's what made it what it was.
Okay, so you got, it says you two Grammy nominations for Trinity 5-7 and the GMA Dove Award for Best Urban Recorded Song of the Year for Listen, which peaked at number 9 on Billboard Gospel. Let's listen to just a little bit of it.
Okay.
For people who don't know. Ready? Okay, let's just do a little sample.
Listen here! Thank you.
my a fader doesn't work very well. It's kind of a non-smooth transition. But anyway.
Okay, so all that sound that sounded like clapping.
Yeah.
Like that is actually, I was banging out the beat on my body with microphones around. And the kick drum sounds was my partner and I stomping on the floor over a regular kick drum. That's why it sounds so big. Boom, boom, boom. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, what do you call that? Do you call that just guerrilla production or just going for what works? Or what do you call it?
Well,
that's fantastic.
You know,
gosh, the sound.
Yeah, yeah. If I told you, like, people would say, what was it like, you know, working with Beyonce or anything? Because we worked on her project, it was specifically on the Birthday album, which kind of has that same feel, all the single ladies, as that song you just heard. So we made music in a small studio over a garage on an outdated Mac G4 at that time. I mean, now, obviously, we use updated stuff, but at that time, we were writing. That's what we were using. And there was a saying, I hope I can remember it, that you're only stifled by your own creativity. Mm. It's something we used to live by. I mean, you can make it happen. You know, you can make magic happen. You know, sometimes when you're doing something for so long, that's why I tell people just to stay with it, you know, because, you know, if they're looking to find their way in their career, when you keep doing it, then you know really what good is, and then the industry is saying what you're doing is good. Sometimes people like think, oh, what they're doing is great, but it doesn't really hit the industry standard. This goes to show you that even when, I mean, just imagine, well, maybe don't imagine, but imagine, like I did that probably 5 separate tracks, so it was me banging out the rhythm on my body, on my chest, probably bare-chested, if I can remember, and legs, to get that kind of slapping, clapping sound. So,
wow.
You know, I was really beating myself up. But it was just amazing. It was magic that was happening. And sometimes, with modern recording technology, you know, they put everything on a grid and everything lines up perfectly, and that's good too. But sometimes you just go with it. Because you make it too perfect and it loses its mojo. And that single and the other single was I Need You was the other single on that album. They just really had that mojo, and that's what made those singles that they are.
Uh-huh. I can imagine, too, though, on the other side, do you have to go home and explain to somebody why you're so beat up? I mean, are they going to, you know, I'm just saying.
Well, you know what?
Not that it's any of my business. But
okay. No, not at that time. I didn't know. And,
okay. You know, sometimes I'm going to let you up. What?
What's that?
I was going to say I'm going to let you off the hook because I've got a caller.
Okay, good.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling Madam Perry Salon. I'm here with Frank DeVille Greenfield. And come on in and introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Ben Fawn, musician from Asheville, North Carolina.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, guys.
How you doing? And Ben
I'm doing
Fawn.
Well, thanks.
Good. Ben Fawn is a musician. I haven't seen you yet, but I will next weekend, I believe, or the weekend after. But you're a musician, Ben Fawn, and the Soulful Symphony. Is that right?
It's the Soul Symphony.
Soul Symphony. Okay. All right. So, glad you came in here tonight. Are you enjoying so far?
Yeah. It's been great. I've been enjoying listening.
All right. Well, I'm not. I'm trying to get some dirt out of the bills I can sell to the people. But, huh? Go ahead. I just said that I was trying to get some dirt out of DeVille about some showbiz types so I can sell to People magazine, but I haven't yet. But I'm still having a good time. So
nice.
So come on. So you have a question for DeVille, Ben?
I was just listening to what you're saying about the recording process, and I can relate more so to the doing it yourself and at home. And my band is going into the studio in January, and we're going into a really nice studio, and I'm hoping to really capture our live sound while also, you know, playing with a click track and using really good production. So if you have any advice on how to do it, you know, really professional production wise and not lose some of that, you know, live magic, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think too, it depends on, do you have somebody that's producing you, or are you guys producing yourself, or?
Yeah, it's Matt Williams. He's won some awards for his producing from the Eagle Room in Asheville, if you're familiar.
Okay, so is he kind of known for that kind of, you know, capturing that kind of sound?
I'm not sure exactly. I know that a lot of the people that I've talked to in the research that I've been recommended, I work with him for my kind of band. And I know him personally.
Yeah.
He's a great, great fiddle player.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, see, all that stuff is really integral because he'll understand, you know, what it takes to, you know, like a good producer, you know, they'll understand what the needs are or how to really get your sound across on some kind of, you know, recorded medium. So obviously they have you play to a click because everything is kind of built on that. So are they going to be recording you on tape or Pro Tools, or do you know what?
I'm pretty sure it'll be Pro Tools or something equivalent.
Yeah. Yeah. So does your band has a good live sound then too?
I like to think so. We definitely improvise.
Yeah,
we definitely improvise a lot, and everybody takes solos. And I practice to a click a lot as well, so I'm hoping that will help.
Oh, so you're a drummer or you're a...
No, I'm a guitar player, singer, songwriter. I practice to a metronome every day.
Yeah, so do I. Absolutely. That's good. Gives you impeccable timing. Yeah, you know, a lot of that, you know, depends on... you know, like I said, the kind of producer and how he captures the sound and, again, the medium. But, you know, Pro Tools, it's so real, you know, now. And the plugins are just so outstanding that there's almost nothing that you can't do. And, of course, the editing qualities in Pro Tools are just are wonderful. So... you know, if you have a great live sound and the guy knows how to mic up everything really good, the engineers, I mean, you should really be able to. A lot of it is, you know, experimental. That's why I said, you know, before, we spent a lot of time doing what we did and still do, you know how to get great sounds using certain things, you know, and not all of them were conventional. You know, I love, like, the Black Keys is a great example of guys that really went totally analog and old school. Or, you know, Jack White is a great, I mean, I love,
right.
You know, what he does with tape machines. He just captures it. Some of it might not be in perfect time or even in key that good, but, you know, it just has an incredible vibe, right?
Right.
And that's the key, is capturing that, you know, that vibe. And sometimes I think with all the, you know, the plugins and everything, you can, you know, like I said before, I found that when you line stuff up really perfectly on the grid, sometimes it starts to lose, it really loses something.
Right.
You know, I was working on a project and that happened. Once we made it too perfect, it was like, well, this is no good. And it wasn't always in time. The drums were in time, but other things like that really nudged the vocals, like the guitar and the bass. It really lent itself to its own magic. You know, so your ears have to kind of be the judge. You know, is this really good? Is it, you know? That's kind of how it works.
Cool. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's definitely a lot to think
about.
Yeah,
man. Yeah, good luck with the project.
And hey,
you.
Ben, you're going to be at the Gray Eagle coming up soon. We'll go ahead and give you a plug here. You're going to be at the Gray Eagle in Nashville. What night?
That's going to be
what
Sunday,
night?
December 11th. Doors at 6, show at 7, and Hannah Kemener is opening for us.
Okay, and I think I will be there. And also, why don't we, you know what we should do, Ben, since you know everybody there and you know the people at Gray Eagle, do you think we can somehow get Frank DeVille to come to Asheville and play with where we can all see him live? Can we sweet talk you? You've been down south before, haven't you, Frank? You're not afraid of coming down here, are you?
I'm not afraid, no.
Okay.
Where
I
are you based,
feel like Sylvester Stallone in Rhinestone.
Los Angeles.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'd have to work our budget up to probably get him out here, I think.
Oh, yeah, there is that. Well, let's see. Half the band can stay at my house, half can stay at yours. How's that?
Okay. Works with me.
Well, park the tour bus in the backyard. How's that?
Right.
Ben,
perfect.
Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks,
Frank. Appreciate it.
All right. Ben Fon, he's such a cool guy and a good player. So we also have on here Ray D'Africo. Come on in, Ray.
Oh, hello. I made it in time.
Oh,
hey,
good,
Ray.
Good. Hey. Ray, meet Frank DeVille, and I think Ben Fon is still here, too. Say hello to Ben.
Yeah,
hey there. How's it going? I just want you to – I'm a Jersey boy, too, and a Pennsylvania boy. So.
You're from Jersey, or you're still there?
No. I lived in New Brunswick. I grew up – I was born in New York City, but I lived in New Brunswick and Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philly's my town. That's where I moved. I lived there for years, man. So you're an East Coaster.
Oh, cool,
yeah.
Yeah,
awesome.
My family's all from there, yeah. So.
Oh, that's cool.
But I've been in the South for a long time, you know, so it's okay to come down here now.
Oh, Ray.
The party can start now that you're there, right?
Put that in. That's our in-joke.
Ray D'Africo has been he's been around a lot. He got extremely popular in the 90s with your band the Night Porters. Pretty much been around the world with them, played with or opened with some major folks.
Some
new stuff.
That's right. I'm still playing, keeping at it. But, you know, I thought I'd call in and find out a little bit more about what you're doing. I guess you're doing some screen stuff and background music, I guess.
Well, actually, I have my career kind of started doing records for pop and R&B artists.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing that. You know, I have a publishing deal now that provides me opportunities for licensing. So I have about 60 songs right now that are licensed for, you know, TV and film. Some of it is background, but, like, I have a song, a theme song for the TV show Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Cool.
That's the song that I wrote with two other guys, and there's Shameless, The Good Wife. I have to even look at my
Secret Life of an American Teenager.
Yeah,
Lincoln Heights, Knight Rider, Entourage.
Right. Entourage.
Your turn.
Community.
Well, no, you're all over the place. That's great. Yeah,
but I have I've been given those opportunities. After I procured my publishing deal, because they're always looking, that's how you get those licensing opportunities. So,
yeah, I've been trying to pursue that myself, so that's good advice. I appreciate it. I know it's a hard field to break into, but, you know.
It is, actually, but that's where, I'm not to say where that's all the money is, because I'm finding out, you know, as you probably already know, the music industry is, it's difficult to navigate and difficult to, you know, to monetize. So music licensing is one way, you know, obviously if you're, you know, touring. So I joined the Gap Band back in May. So we've done a couple of dates, but we're going, you know, back out full steam after the new year. And
well, that's good.
But in the same time, you know, I worked, you know, all weekend on another project for a label. So hopefully those songs will get placed. So I'm still writing records, working on, you know, on being a creative producer. And again, you know, there's other, you know, my music catalog is always being promoted by my company. They're actually on the East Coast, the Missing Link Music. That's who my publishing administrator is, and the Harry Fox Agency. So if you're looking to do that, that's the it's almost like you got to have a music catalog to get it, you know, to get those opportunities. So it's kind of a music supervisor, if you know any music supervisors. There's something I just found out through LinkedIn, a company called Music to Deal, where they provide opportunities. They vet everyone very carefully. They provide opportunities for the people that want to license. There's people with music to license, you know.
Right. Well, I've been writing songs since I was 17, and I keep writing. Like, it's just, I write them just to get them out of my head.
you might
be the same way. You know, some people just, like, can't seem to stop making music, you know. I mean, for writers anyway, you know. Maybe that's a good outlet for you to get, you know, stuff out there, you know. Because there's the performing part of it, and then there's the just creating part, you know.
Well, yeah, there is. My mom said to me a couple of years ago, she said, you know, you've had some success out there. You were never about the money, Frank. You just wanted to be good. And I said, Mom, it's about the money. It really is about the money.
Oh, you shut her down. Wow.
Well, I didn't shut her. It was so in the past, my perception of the industry, and even, you know, I think there was obviously, as artists, we're dealing with a little bit of validation. So I got that validation, but then, you know, I don't know if I need to tell you how expensive it is to live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, you need all those revenue streams. You need to be out touring. You have to have a viable music catalog, you know, with your stuff getting placed. You have to have somebody representing your mechanical, your worldwide mechanical rights, which is, it's now it's not just the CDs, but it's the digital downloads. It's the ringtones.
Right.
It's on digital jukebox. It's every single realm that there is. Streaming services, which doesn't pay anything, but
yeah,
still,
my concern is that you get paid so little for that. I mean, maybe some pay more than others, but it's in my experience that, you know, it's very difficult with that because you can get many plays and not get any money. You know, it's like frustrating. You know, I mean. Obviously, I think the artist should be paid more, you know, but I think they're just trying to figure that part out. So I don't know, but I hear you. I mean, about living out there. I guess that's why I live here. Although Atlanta's getting expensive too, you know, everywhere's getting expensive.
But you're right. I just was recently involved in advocacy for the Grammys because I'm a voting member of the Grammys. And the way that they pay music creators and producers, there was a Songwriters Act in 1902 which paid 2 cents per sound recording. Jump to the year 2016, in the digital realm, it pays 0.02 cents per stream.
That's like backward progress.
It is. But see, what's happened is the copyright laws in Congress and the way that they look at laws have not changed since the 70s. So,
yeah.
You know, I know a little bit about the business, but when I went in, to this meeting with my state representative from California with like five other people, and it was a lot of writers with much more credentials than I had. One guy said, I had 1 billion streams last year. That's with a B. Billion.
Mm-hmm.
And my check was 11 grand.
Wow.
So I'm like, when I heard that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, who's this dude written for? So he had anything that's on pop radio, he's got like two or three songs out there right now. I mean, really an extremely established writer. But he said there's money out there, but you got to diversify. And
right.
you got to fight for what, you know, we have to, you know, fight and advocate, you know, write your congressman to get on. It's called the Fair Play Act.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, they haven't changed the way that they divide up royalties since the 70s. And there's
wow.
also a preconceived misconception that people who are making music, you know, they've got this great life and they're enjoying what they're doing. And look at them. You see about all these artists and they're millionaires, but it's not true.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So,
I know all about that.
Yeah. But if you're out gigging and you're writing songs, I mean, you know, the thing is, like, I just tell people just stay in your lane and keep putting one foot in front of the other, you know. There's
yeah.
sometimes hard times, and then, you know, like, all it takes is a couple songs, and then you can change, you know, can change your life, but then you need more, so.
yeah, exactly. Your third album syndrome, you know, whatever
mm-hmm.
they used to call it, you know. It's like, oh, okay. Had your whole life to write the first one, and then, you know, you need
yeah.
another 12 songs, you know, just as good.
Listen to you, and I like the fact that, as you said, you know, you're being a voting member of NARA for the Grammys, and that you do advocate, you do get out and talk to the congressman and get out there rather than just talk about money. DeVille, you actually get out
yeah.
there and talk to somebody that can make a difference. And I thought, here I'm sitting listening to you guys, and I'm thinking, oh, the two cents and one two-hundredth of a cent, and I'm thinking, okay, over here, I was thinking that maybe, you know, as long as you got an Uptown Funk in your bag, you're doing good. But then again, how do I know? He may not be doing – Mark Ronson might be going – he might be hitting me up for a sandwich next week. I don't know. But we
mm-hmm.
have one more person that's going to join our party here, and let's
okay.
see. Hi, welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I'm here with Frank DeVille Greenville, Ray D'Africo, and Ben Fon. Come out and introduce yourself. Join the party.
Would that be me?
That would be you.
That would be.
Oh, hi. Hey, it's Jim Johnson.
Yes,
hey, Ray.
Jim Johnson.
I know you.
Hi, Jennifer.
Yeah.
Hey. Last time I saw you, I think you were either playing at Blind Willie's or you took a photo. You took a photo of me and Rod Argent and Colin Blundstone, either you or Lee Valentine. But anyway, DeVille, Jim Johnson.
Masquerade.
Jim Johnson is a photographer and works in the film industry, and he's a musician too. And you've done a lot of photographs of concerts and famous musicians, haven't you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm putting out a book
okay.
of some of my
cool.
pictures next year.
Another book.
All right. Well,
yeah,
you will
yeah.
talk later about you need to publish this. Wink, wink. So.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be something weird. I'll tell you about that later. But
okay.
I wanted to make mention here, Frank, about you mentioned Tommy Tedesco, and I met him at
yes.
a NAMM show in '99. And he was a super guy, and I was glad to meet him. And, of course, you know, we all know what a great asset he was to music in general. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I did. I met him. You said you met him in 99?
Yeah, it was 98. I mean, I'm sorry, 89. God, I can't think. I'm old.
Well,
we're all old.
Because I'm like... Wait, 99, let's see, because I came out here to Los Angeles in 2003. I met him in a music store. He was doing, I don't know, some kind of demonstration for something, and he was really a cordial guy and, you know, really talkative. And so I did meet him once, but I've been very influenced by him. I don't know, there was just something about he was so well versed, right? You know, and just incredibly schooled, and you know, he played mandolin and banjo, and he had really like a lot of great advice. That's actually when I picked up the mandolin. Was he's like, just learn things that you're going to use. You know, you don't need to, you know, like it was one thing to study classical and jazz, but I didn't want to study like banjo, but I wanted to learn how to play one, you know, or mandolin. And so I ended up just being able to pick them, you know, pick those things up and, you know, play them a little bit so I could use them in the studio, kind of like he did, you know. So I just thought it was awesome, you know, his legacy and all that, yeah. So
yeah, his son is really nice too. He made
that film, I guess,
The Wrecking Crew.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was really funny, and it's mentioned in the movie, I think, because I saw the movie once. Also, is that the you know, Tommy had this great idea, just to tune everything like a guitar. You know, like a mandolin has its own tuning and a banjo has its own tuning, but everything was just tuned like a guitar so you could just pick it up and play it. And nobody knew, you know, because...
That's right.
He was just playing it. And, you know, there's a lot of people like me, and I pick up a mandolin and you know, that tuning is just befuddling and I can't do anything with it, but I know that it makes that instrument sound like it. Like it does, that's why it's tuned like that. But
yes.
I also wanted to ask you quickly, who was your first production job? Who was the first band you went into the studio with, whether they made it or not, or, you know, maybe they did, you know? Who did you think
the first,
you know, your teeth
yeah, the first
time?
Yeah, it was really interesting because what a learning experience, I'll tell you. It was my band. In Philadelphia, we were called Kingdom of Souls. We were a three-piece rock funk. And we probably went as far as we could in that area. It was kind of, you know, outside Philadelphia, Bucks County area. But, you know, we played a lot around in Philly, and we got signed to this little label. And... It was a great recording. I learned an awful lot. We were using another singer. So it was three-piece guitar, bass, and drums, and a singer. And the producer didn't like the singer. He said, well, you know, you wrote the song, so you're going to sing them. And oh, it was so humbling. I mean, I can sing, but this guy, at that time, it was like, you know, they wanted a singer that was going to, you know, belt out. So I was working with a vocal producer and, you know, I was also working a day gig. So, I mean, it was really hard, you know, being up all night, but it was part of it. And I also learned something else very valuable, that the drummer, bless his heart, was a wonderful friend. And the producer said, look, this guy's drumming is all over the place, man. He's got to play to a click. And that thing right there, I put friendship before business, and it turned into a disaster. It was, you know, it's good to be friends with people, but when it came down to making a recording, you know, it really botched the recording.
Yeah.
So, but it was really a learning process. And even though it didn't really take off, you know, it was like being in boot camp. You know, and even when I moved out to L.A., some of the bigger artists that the major artists we were working for, like there was such a high standard that there was. So we were like climbing to hit that standard. And, you know, like I said before, when you're writing for an artist, they want two songs, you're writing five or six. And so... You know, I think the first guy we wrote for out here was a hip hop guy named Mace. And we thought it was going to happen, and something happened and it fell through. But we were still doing it. We were still pursuing it, still perfecting our craft. And even like my old band back in Philly, you know, those guys still hate me to this day, I think. But, like, I continued to perfect my craft, and they didn't. And that's the only thing that separates us. It's not that I'm any more talented than anyone else. I just stuck with it, you know. And they didn't rise to the occasion. You know, play to a click track, dude. You know, play your parts. Or else, you know, we'll program the drums. You know?
He wasn't able to play to the click track, or he just didn't want to?
Good question. I never understood which one. Which one? Yeah, I don't know.
Did you guys ever do anything at Sigma Sound in Philly before it closed?
Oh, yes. Sigma, absolutely.
That's the sound of Philly right there, you know.
That was the sound of Philly. Yeah, a little bit before my time, but Sigma Sound. Ended up, I think, becoming a rehearsal studio called the Opera House.
Oh, wow.
I think it's building. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I was just curious, you know, how long it was. I think closed in, like, the 80s or 90s or something, but.
Yeah.
Well, they
that
did
Philadelphia
a lot of good
sound
stuff
is,
there, though.
It's gone. It's gone. Now, there is the Philadelphia sound now. If you went back and checked out clubs, there'd be like a rap metal kind of sound.
My friend Andy lived up there. He was in my band, and he was telling me that. You know, I grew up in the 70s in Philly, so I got, you know, that, you know, kind of what, like Todd Rundgren and that kind of stuff. And, you know, what was around then. You know, I was a kid, but I still picked up on it, you know, because it was around. So.
Sure, absolutely.
But,
you know, I'm so glad you put it the part too, Frank, about having to rise to the occasion and continue to build and train in your craft, because that is what puts people a cut above. And when you're looking at it from the other side, from the people doing the work and the production and so forth, you know, you got a lot of time and a lot of money put into it, and you don't have time for everybody, I guess, to keep on doing it over and over, or getting somebody who can line up those digital things to make you in time. I don't know if you know the drummer Forrest Robinson, Jim or Frank or
no
Ray. Do you know him?
Mm-mm.
Okay, he was my drummer.
I don't think
so. After he left, okay, but he was in Atlanta for a while. He was my drummer, but after he left TLC, or after TLC quit touring, I got him, and then he left me to work with India RE. But the point is, when he was doing a lot of studio work back then. He's out in L.A. now, but he said the first time a big group hired him for studio work, I don't know if it was SOS band, you know, funk band, somebody like that. He said they were so nice to me, and we were having a great time, and they were just so warm and welcoming, and, you know, they loved my playing, and he's a monster, you know, Forrest is. And he said, but we were having a good time. They made me feel so welcome, like I was part of the group. He said then they sat down and put the headphones on, and it was a click track. I'd never worked with a click track. He said, and we started, and I didn't know what to do. He said, all of a sudden, all those smiles went away. And everybody quit joking and laughing and smiling. And everybody started looking at each other and exchanging these looks, and they talking amongst themselves. And then they come back, and they said, okay, after a little while, they said, okay, we're going to leave. We're going to go out for a while, about an hour, and leave you here alone with that click track to think you can get with it. And he goes, yeah, man, just leave me alone with it. Man, I got it. I knew that before they got back, I was going to know how to work this thing. And it still does. But, yeah, and at that time, you're learning that from him. I kept thinking, oh, Farr's such a great player. But, yeah, you got to be – there's a lot of time and money in there that you can't waste. You need all.
That's right. There is. When you go into a studio, no matter, you know, if it's your band or you come in, you know, like – that's the whole thing, is they don't want to be doing five or six or, you know, overdubbing tom parts or cymbal parts or, like, that's whack. You know, who's got time for that? There's no budgets for that anymore. You know?
Right.
But here's the thing, too. Like, my buddy is out. What's that?
No. Roll on.
My buddy was telling me that Mick Fleetwood from Fleetwood Mac does not have a real good sense of time. So... you know, I guess there's an argument on both sides. You know, I guess he's got the band, and he can say what's up.
Depends on the kind of music you're playing too, I think. Some of it lends itself for, I don't know, you know, it's different when you're trying to cut a track and get it down in the studio then, you know. But like apparently Keith Moon, when they were doing Quadrophenia, couldn't follow any of the synth tracks, you know, especially live, you know. I mean, he just did his own thing, you know. But I hear you that, you know, time is money when you're recording, you know. I've just recorded some stuff in New York, and it was under the gun. You know, we had tight budget, and, you know, since I'm writing the songs, I hear them all in my head. You know, it's hard sometimes to tell people what you want them to play, you know. Sometimes it could be frustrating, you know. It's like, but I hear you. So.
Yeah, each situation is different, you know, when if a producer comes in and says the drummer has to work with the click track, that's pretty much how it goes, especially if it's the label is paying for it and they bring this producer in specifically because in my instance, they wanted like a tight, you know, bass and drums. They wanted everything to be built on, you know, layered drum sounds, tons of background vocals. And, you know, it had to be right. It had to be on time.
Right.
So, you know, this guy was like, "Well, I'm not going to do that, or I can't do it, or I don't want to do it." So, you know, it's all part of it. It's like, you know, either you rise to it and do it, or you just, you know, go down in flames.
Yeah.
You know? So, unfortunately, like those guys, like they never did anything with their careers again after that. You know, so it's just unfortunate. Again, the only thing that is that when I was, you know, faced with some kind of an obstacle or, you know, something that was burdensome I needed to work through, you know, I just did it, you know. Practiced the hours and put the time in and just kept doing it until I'm going to do it or I'm going to die trying, you know.
Right.
So...
So, you know, time is especially important in film music when you're – I do some editing, so, you know, that's a whole other timing art, you know. So if you're doing any of that kind of stuff, it's really important, but that's my two cents. But
most everything I did for film and TV was songs that were, you know, already pop songs. And with – you know, some of these music supervisors, they're or people that are making music songs for film and TV, you know, that's you got music supervisors that are looking for something specific, you know, in a pop song, but it's got to be really produced well. You don't ever submit, nobody's taking demos anymore. It's got to be like radio ready, on point, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why it's good, you know, to record on Pro Tools with some good editing, a little bit of mastering. Even when you're submitting songs for a big artist, they want to hear how that song's going to be banging through the radio. You know, they don't want to imagine that the drums are going to sound like this, the guitar's going to sound like this. They want it, like, done. So that's kind of changed the whole game with music now and how you submit stuff for music, for film and TV, or even for pop artists, you know.
Right.
So...
Right. Yeah. You know, I think, I know that of the few things that I really know for sure, one is that I have kept the bill much longer than I told him I would, and you've been so gracious and generous about it, DeVille. And before I go, I want to thank B.B. Queen. B.B. Queen is a banging blues guitarist. She lives in Nashville, and her mentor was Coco Taylor, none other than, she was the person that called earlier, but she couldn't stay till we got in. So, B.B. Queen, we love you, and we're glad that you did call and that you've been listening. Also, thanks to Ben Fon for calling in, and David Hurley for his questions, and everybody that's listening right now, and Jim Johnson, Ray D'Africo. DeVille, I just want to get some few things out for people, too. They can. You've got a YouTube channel, but you don't have, I'm going to straight up tell you, because, you know, you and I have been talking lately. So I feel like we're friendly enough to where I can say something, right?
Sure.
DeVille. All right. You need more videos on there. We need more of you on there, okay? We need more DeVille videos on your YouTube channel. And so you can get on there and
that's
watch
okay.
him.
That's
okay. You can follow him
that's
on
okay.
Twitter. I'll have, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. It is with the social media, you know, I've been, and I've been changing a lot of things because, you know, being on tour with the Gap Band, there's a lot of video stuff that I haven't posted on there. We've got new management and a unforeseen thing that the Gap Band needed to work out as far as for promotion. So I'm gonna be stepping that up. But yeah, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. So yes, it's all
You're good.
Good
at that. You really, yeah. Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter. In fact, that's where you and I met, was on LinkedIn. So thank you so much.
On LinkedIn,
being
yeah.
Here. You're so savvy, tech, so cyber savvy, so hip to the jive. And
no,
we want to
really,
get you to Atlanta. We want to get you all over the town. Gap Band, I love the Gap. You know how I feel about funk bands, but Gap Band.
Yes.
I've got to see
yes.
you on tour with them. And I'll bring these two guys with me, Jim and Ray.
Yeah,
you guys will go
you.
With me, won't you? Okay.
Absolutely.
Jim,
we'll be coming
me?
To a city near you. I can assure you,
all
yeah.
Right. Hey, and will you tell us real quick before we go? And again, I know I've kept you too long, but thank you. Tell us how you got with the Gap Band, because I think it's a cool story.
I will tell you. So I was out doing a small gig with Clint June. It was at a place called GS Lounge. It's a small kind of venue, but well known by the LAX airport. And Clint and I had played there, you know, several times, and we'd play a couple of his originals. And then there's like some Prince songs that we do. And it was right after Prince died. And so we play with a house band, and I play guitar. And of course, Clint sings. And they're just, if I may say so myself, we're just, you know, completely tearing it up. But then afterwards, so I get off stage, and there's a dude there with his, you know, wearing sunglasses. And he said, yeah, I'm a PA for Ronnie Wilson and the Gap Band, and you are a badass white boy on that guitar. I'm gonna have a spot for you. And I didn't even know this dude. I didn't even know this brother. So I said, "Yeah, the Gap Band? Are you kidding?" So I said, "Here's my card." He goes, "We're gonna be, you know, doing this tour. We'll be out in LA." And I'm like, "Okay, well, you know, I kind of didn't really know him, but I was like, man, that would be dope." So as I'm walking out, I even told my girlfriend, I'm like, you know, I just wasn't on tonight. You know, I just felt like it was maybe one of them, you know, I was playing to somebody else's gear. This guy's sound was real sterile, and it was like, blah. And she said, I think it was the best you ever played. Anyway, 2 weeks later, I get the call from him, from Roy, who's the personal assistant for Ronnie Wilson in the Gap Band. He goes, yeah, we're out in L.A., and I find out that, you know, they're from all over the country. They're from Arizona, from Detroit, all over. So they were out here, you know, to rehearse for a week. And Roy says to me, how soon can you be out, you know, to Hollywood after I call you? I said, I'll be packed and ready. I'll be there in an hour. What songs do I need to learn? And he said, listen to the Gap Band live. Listen to the guitar and the Gap Band live. Because it's not like some of the old disco versions. It's, you know, got a lot of guitar. So I just, you know, rehearsed, and it was on a Tuesday. It was at 2:30. I remember this, and they called me and said, okay, come on over. And I was like, you know, I got this. This gig is mine. There's no doubt about this. So I got there in an hour, set my stuff up. They're already in there rehearsing. And Ronnie Wilson says to me, okay, we're going to play this song. It might have been You Dropped a Bomb on Me or one of their hits. He goes, when I point to you, you solo. And he said, you ready? I said, yeah, I'm ready. And that was it. Did the one song. He said, okay, you're in.
Oh, wow.
He said, you're dope.
Good job.
You're amazing. Yeah. So, again, you know, all that training, all that classical and jazz training, knowing how to play over a chord progression, you know, knowing where I'm at all the time, not just playing some pentatonic thing, just being able to, you know, just off the cuff. And that's something I do well. And I kind of cultured that, you know, with my, you know, all the time I spent in the studios, coming in, working on a project, and just coming in, you know, totally cold and coming up with something, living on the edge like that. So that's really where that training came in. So that's how I got it. And
all right.
Yeah. So I'm in. I'll stay with him as long as possible.
All right. Hey, you badass white boy player. And you know who else I loved so much that we lost this year that used to play a little Gap Band trivia. Who was one of their early guitar players? Out in Texas.
A guy named Jimmy Macon? Marco, is that it?
I was thinking of Leon Russell.
Oh, Leon Russell. Yeah, the Gap Band was his first backup band. Yep.
Or maybe them. Yeah.
Well, I think I have that album, actually. That first Gap Band album on vinyl.
Wow.
Really?
I think you're right. Yeah, I think now that you mention it, I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes, yeah. It's like on
mm-hmm.
Shelter Records or something, I think. But
Ray, you're
wow.
All right. Well, you know what? I know I'm going to have to let you go before I have to start paying some kind of royalties to you, and I've only got a couple of nickels right now. So I'm going to leave it. As we were talking earlier about you, DeVille, thank you so much. Will you come back to Madame Perry Salon sometime?
I absolutely will. Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor speaking with the guests, I'd love speaking to people about the industry and finding their lane, you know, making it happen.
Thank you so very
nice
much.
To meet you.
I really appreciate it. And hang on, guys. I was mentioning earlier, Jim, earlier, I don't know if you were listening then, but we were talking about fashion. We said, you know, the fashion part of rock and roll and music and live music, and the hair, the styling, and so forth. And then I found
mm-hmm.
out that recently, I think it was recently, you've heard of Fashion Week, like New York Fashion Week, London, Paris Fashion Week. Would you believe that the fashionable DeVille played on opening night at an event for New York Fashion Week. Am I right?
LA Fashion Week.
LA
Fashion Week it was. Mm-hmm.
I'm a knucklehead. LA Fashion Week. Of course, I should have known. LA Fashion Week. And it sounded something like this, and this is what we're going to go out on. Good night, everyone, Madame Perry Salon. I think you're all wonderful. Be nice to each other this week. And thanks again to DeVille.
Thank you.